Tonight's shiur, I think I may have given here a number of years ago, but first of all, if I don't remember, it's possible that you don't remember. And it's such, to my mind, I'm not saying this because it's my shiur, it happens to be, it's such a powerful, for me, explanation of how the Haggadah works, that I think it bears repetition even if we've even if we've done it before. So if it is Chazara, if it is some review, so hopefully it will be good and certainly get us in the mood for Pesach. You know what? What's that? You don't need one. I mean, I can do it, but I think we can do it well enough. You know, we're getting into smart board, you know, so this looks very smart, so a lot of books. So I'll try to present that. I think it's, in a certain level, it's obviously, it's easier when you see it in the Haggadah, but it's so simple and basic. It's one of these things that's simple and profound all at the same time. You know, one of the things that always struck me, you know, really from a very young age while going through the Haggadah on the night of the Seder, was how disorganized the Haggadah seemed to be at first glance. You know, here we sit down to a meal which is called a Seder. Seder means order. So you would figure that that means that it's in a very, very particular order. And we have a mitzvah to recount the story of how we left Mitzrayim, you know, how we left Egypt. And the way the story is presented, I mean, the whole section of the Haggadah, which is called the Maggid, which is essentially the story of how we left, is presented in such, on the surface, such a disjointed fashion that you think to yourself, if I was writing this in a million years, I would never write such a quote-unquote disorganized presentation. We start talking, you know, here we are, we're supposed to talk about how we left Mitzrayim. So all of a sudden we're talking about five rabbis sitting around in Bnei Brak and talking about the story the whole night. And we're talking about Rebbe Elazar ben Azariah. I was like 70. I kind of was 70. I was sort of like 70. And then we're talking about Lavan. And then we're having a whole bunch of psukim, which we don't really understand. Then there's Dayenu. Okay, Dayenu at least we get. And finally we get to Pesach Matzah Maror, which we know, okay, that's a really important part. Rabban Gamliel says that if you didn't mention Pesach, Matzah, and Maror, you haven't fulfilled your obligation. So I ask you, if it's so important, why not put it right at the beginning of the Maggid, right after the kid asks the Manishtana? Right? I mean, let him ask the questions, and let Rabban Gamliel come and say, there are three really important things you have to know about Pesach, Matzah, and Maror. In a general sense, the whole presentation of the story on the night of the Seder is really hard to follow. If you didn't know the story sitting down to read the Haggadah, you probably wouldn't be able to figure it out from the Haggadah itself. Very, very hard. You know, if somebody were to ask you, you know, okay, you closed the Haggadah at the end of Maggid. Okay, what happened, right? What happened? What was the story? If you didn't know the story going in, you would probably not be able to really tell over the story from the Haggadah itself.
Maybe that's excellent. Manishtana is also the presentation is shone from a regular historical presentation.
Okay, so let's talk about it a little bit. A number of years back, I found the following explanation in the introduction that the Malbim writes to his Haggadah. The Malbim, as we know, is one of the great biblical commentators of the 19th century. Malbim was really, he used the last name Malbim as a last name. Malbim actually is Rashi Tevis, it's an acronym. It stands for Meir Leibush Ben Yechiel Michel. That was really Malbim. He was a Rav in various parts of Europe in the 19th century. He had a really difficult career in the Rabbanus. He was probably the proof of the pudding was he was not a Rav in one place. He was a Rav in many places. At certain points in his career, got into fights with various elements in the towns where he served, and was actually reported onto the authorities and thrown into jail. I mean, things like that. Really a hard career in the Rabbanus. And yet, you know, with all of that, the Malbim produced, you know, what is arguably one of the most basic commentaries on Tanakh, where, you know, to this day, it's very hard to open up a Pasuk in Nach and try to understand it without referencing the Malbim. And in addition to that, he also wrote a commentary in the Haggadah. In this introduction to his Haggadah, the Malbim says something which is simple and profound all at once. And the minute I finished reading through this, I said, wow. Sometimes you read something, you say, okay, that's nice. Then sometimes you read an explanation, you say, wow, that's true. That's 100% true. And it's so true that I don't understand how I didn't realize this before I read the Malbim. It's like so simple, and again, so complex and profound at the same time. So now that I've built the whole thing up, let's see what the Malbim says. Comes the Malbim and he says, the entire Magid section of the Haggadah is structured exactly around the Pasuk in Chumash, which teaches us the mitzvah of Magid, of telling over the story of Yetzias Mitzrayim. The Pasuk which teaches us the story of Yetzias Mitzrayim says, V'gadato levincha bayom ahu leimor, you should tell your son on that day saying, quote unquote, Ba'avur zeh asa Hashem li b'tzeisi mi'mitzrayim, because of this, God did these things for me when I left Egypt. Says the Malbim, when the author of the Haggadah wrote the Haggadah, and parenthetically, he suggests that the author of the Haggadah in the style in which we have it was Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi, who wrote the Mishnayos. You know, it's not totally clear who actually wrote the Haggadah, right? So he suggests that Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi, who wrote down the Mishnayos, was also the author, the compiler, the editor of the Haggadah, at least the basic Haggadah. I mean, some of the stuff, you know, some of the songs were obviously added on later on, but, you know, the basic kernel of the Haggadah was written, he suggests, by Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi. And he says it's almost as if Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi had the Pasuk in front of him and basically was looking at that Pasuk as he wrote the Haggadah. That Pasuk, says the Malbim, can be subdivided into six phrases, and each section of the Maggid corresponds in turn to one of those phrases. So let me lay it out for you. And again, my experience was, by the time I finished reading this, it was just like, well, yeah, that's actually what it means, you know, like so straightforward. But again, like many things in life, you know, the more straightforward and obvious it is, the less we thought about it, you know, beforehand. Says the Malbim, part one of the Maggid is based around the word in Hebrew, v'higadata, you shall tell. And the first question that the Baal Haggadah, the author of the Haggadah, sought to answer in the Maggid is, who are you? Right? Not who are you, but v'higadata, you should tell. Who's the you? You know, who is referenced in the Pasuk?
The father.
Oh, so one second. Who has the obligation to tell over the story of Yetzias Mitzrayim? Is it everybody? Are there exceptions made for people who have been saying the story every single year and know it until it's coming out of their ears? So let's take a look at the Maggid from the very beginning. Now again, the very first thing in the Maggid is when the child asks the questions, the Manishtana. That's the prelude, if you will, to the Maggid. But the actual answer, if you will, begins, Avadim hayinu lefaro b'mitzrayim, right? We were slaves to Pharaoh in Egypt. Vayotzeinu Hashem Elokeinu misham b'yad chazaka v'zeh netuya. And God brought us out. Fine. V'afilu goes on that paragraph to say, V'afilu kulanu chachamim, kulanu nevonim, kulanu zekenim. Even if we were all wise and smart and, you know, elderly, right, kulanu yodim es haTorah, even if we all knew the Torah backwards and forwards, mitzvah aleinu lesaper b'tzias Mitzrayim, we still nonetheless have a mitzvah to tell over the story. Right? Why is that line there? Argues the Malbim, because before we even get to the story proper, the first thing that has to be addressed by the author of the Haggadah is that word, v'higadata, you shall tell, who's you, quote unquote. Who is obligated in this story? The Haggadah then goes on to tell the story of the five sages who sat in Bnei Brak and recounted the story of Yetzias Mitzrayim the entire night. Why is that there? Because that basically is the proof to the previous statement. Who are you going to find who are greater sages than Rabbi Akiva, Rabbi Eliezer, Rabbi Yeshua, Rabbi Tarfon, Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah? Even they, with all of their greatness in Torah, stayed up the entire night discussing the story of Yetzias Mitzrayim. The implication is, if they can do it, and they're obligated to do it, why do you think that you're not obligated to do it? V'higadata, you have to tell the story. The next line is, the next phrase, part number two in the Pasuk, is Levincha. You should tell your son. And the question that the author of the Haggadah now has to explore is, we talked about who's obligated to tell. What does your son, quote unquote, mean? Who exactly is supposed to be the recipient of this tale of telling the story of Yetzias Mitzrayim? And here comes the author of the Haggadah and says, guess what? There is no one recipient. There are actually four potential recipients. There are four sons. Right? The Chacham, the Rasha, the Tam, the She'enu Yodea L'Shaul. Now, by the way, it's just something to point out, which, again, I think many people maybe don't realize. Where did the Haggadah get this idea that there are four sons? Right? So the Haggadah got it from the Chumash. There are four places in the Chumash where the Torah speaks of telling your son the story of Yetzias Mitzrayim. Right? That's where we get it from. It's not that, you know, oh, four sons is a very nice number, you know, you can divide the bedrooms nicely that way. No, it's based on the Chumash. The Chumash talks about, in four different places, you know, where we have a mitzvah to tell our children the story of Yetzias Mitzrayim. Why is that there in the Haggadah at that particular point? Because that's the second word in the Pasuk. V'higadata, you shall tell. Levincha, to your son. So now we have to clarify who the son is. Okay, there are four. Meaning, you know, not that any one person has four sons necessarily, but there are four different potential recipients of this story, and you have to adjust the way you tell the story depending who the recipient is going to be. To the son who's wise, you tell the story in one way. To the son who's simple, you tell the story in another way. To the son who doesn't even know how to ask the question, you have a different approach. And to the son who's a Rasha, who's wicked, you smack him. I mean, that's essentially what it says in the Haggadah. Right? So there's a different approach to each of the four children. And the reason we talk about that in the Haggadah is because that's the second phrase in the Pasuk. So let's keep going. We said there are six parts to this Pasuk. V'higadata levincha, you shall tell your son, b'yom ahu, on that day. Right after the four sons are described in the Haggadah, there's a brief paragraph, which, again, by this time, this is where people's attention span starts getting a little bit thin. I'm sure nobody here, but I'm saying the other people, right? So, there's a brief paragraph in the Haggadah that starts off as follows. Yachol me'rosh chodesh. Might you think that you can already start telling the story of Yetzias Mitzrayim from Rosh Chodesh Nisan? Talmud lomar b'yom ahu. To tell you that that's not the case, and that the Seder has to be conducted on the night of the 15th of Nisan. The Pasuk says, which Pasuk? The Pasuk we've been quoting. B'yom ahu, on that day. So in other words, the third question that's being addressed in the Haggadah is, when do we have this mitzvah? And to that, the Haggadah answers, the mitzvah of recounting the story is linked to the first night of Pesach, b'yom ahu, on that night, the night where you eat matzah and maror, the night which begins the observance of Pesach. You can't do it earlier, you can't do it later. So what has really happened at this point in the Haggadah is we haven't really gotten to the story yet. Right? In other words, the reason that it's confusing because here we are, we want to tell the story of how we left Mitzrayim, and instead we're talking about five rabbis and four sons. Right? It's starting to sound like an algebra problem, right? You just need like four on one side, five on another side, a couple of X's and Y's, and you know, like you're doing pre-calculus already, right? But you know, we're talking about five rabbis, four sons, you know, Rosh Chodesh. Like, why are we talking about all this stuff? Why don't we just get to the story? And the answer is that these are all preludes to the story. We first have to answer three questions about, not about the story, but about the mitzvah to tell the story. This is, I think they call it in English meta-knowledge, right? In other words, it's knowledge about the knowledge itself. Who's asking, you know, who's obligated to tell the story? To whom are they obligated to tell the story? When are they obligated to tell the story? Now that we just established those three things, so now we can actually tell the story. And immediately after the, you know, those paragraphs, so the Haggadah launches into the following. Mitchila ovdei avodazara hoyu avosenu v'achshav kervanu hamakom lavodasa. Initially, our forefathers were idolaters, and now God has brought us close to His divine service. In a sense, that is really the beginning of the Maggid section of the Haggadah. Why? Because now we're beginning to tell the story. Because the story of Yetzias Mitzrayim doesn't start with the Ten Makos, or with our leaving, or even with our enslavement. The beginnings of the story of Yetzias Mitzrayim go back to God's choosing us as a nation. Initially we're idolaters, and then God chose Avraham, and then Yitzchak, Yaakov, and Yaakov and his sons went down to Egypt. We have to establish that idea, you know, that history, before we get to the actual story of Yetzias Mitzrayim itself. Right? So it's important to point out that that's really, in a sense, the beginning of the story. Mitchila of the Avodah Zarah Hayu Avoseinu. We then go on in the Haggadah to mention that the story of how we were going to go down to Egypt, be enslaved there, and ultimately taken out, was actually revealed to Avraham Avinu by the Bris Ben Havsarim, right? By the covenant between the pants, right? Between the parts. Right, that's the paragraph that begins, Baruch Shomer Havtachaso LeYisrael Baruch Hu. Right, blessed is God who keeps His promise to the Jewish people. What was the promise? It goes on to say, because Shakadosh Baruch Hu Chishavis Haketz LaSos Kemo Sha'amar LeAvram Avinu, God calculated when we would leave Egypt to be faithful to that which He had told Avram Avinu. Your children are going to go down to a land. They're going to be slaves there for 400 years, and then they're going to leave, they're going to go out, and they're going to be there with great wealth. Right? And here, we come to a part of the Haggadah where most people who are drifting a little bit tend to wake up. Right? What's that part? We cover over the matzahs, we pick up the cup of wine, and we say, probably many people sing, V'hi sha'am dola v'seinu v'lanu. Right? It stood for our forefathers and for us. And one of the things that we may not think about, I mean, again, it's a beautiful Shweki song, it's very nice, but one of the things that we may not think about when we say or sing those words is, what's the it, which is referenced in that phrase? V'hi sha'am dola v'seinu v'lanu. Literally, she, or it, stood for our forefathers and us. So when I was a kid, so one of the things that I heard was, well, Vihi is really Roshei Tevos, you know, it's really an acronym for Vav, the six orders of the Mishnah, Hey, the five books of the Torah, Yud, the Aseres Hadibros, the Ten Commandments, Aleph Hashem, right? So in other words, God, the Aseres Hadibros, the Chumash, and the Mishnayos, the Torah Shebaal Peh, stood for our forefathers and us throughout all of the long years of the Golos. That's a beautiful idea. I mean, the idea is true, but that's certainly not what the Haggadah itself means, right? Every time, we know in grammar, you have a pronoun, there's always an antecedent, right? So if v'hi sha'am dola v'seinu v'lanu, it stood for our forefathers and for us, question is, what's the antecedent? And again, if you just look, again, it's just a matter of, you know, reading the Haggadah as opposed to just kind of flying through the Haggadah. So it's pretty clear from context that the promise, you know, the word promise in Hebrew is haftacha, which is feminine. The promise that God made to Avraham Avinu stands for our forefathers and for us as well. And what the Haggadah is saying, again, without any fancy explanations, just very, very simply, the Haggadah is saying, when God promised Avraham Avinu that the Jews would go down to Egypt, be enslaved there, but ultimately would be freed, that was not just a one-time promise. God was promising that throughout Jewish history, we would encounter various persecutions, and despite all of the persecutions, ultimately God would deliver us from the hands of those who persecute us. Right? The promise that God made to Avraham Avinu was a promise not just for that one-time event, but for all of Jewish history. That's what I'm saying now is not a pshetel, it's not a like a nice, cute explanation. That's just simply what the Haggadah means. Again, think about the words. It stood for our forefathers and for us. It was not only one oppressor who stood up against us to destroy us. Rather, in every generation they stand up against us to destroy us. God saves us from their hands. And again, and this I'm not translating, but this is the implicit message. And all of that entire fact, you know, that pattern was already promised to Avraham Avinu by the Bris Ben Habesarim. So in other words, if we survived as a people, you know, all of the Crusades and the Khmelnytsky massacres and the Holocaust, etc., 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 our survival of all of those things is all part of the promise that God made to Avraham Avinu way back when, that we would go into Egypt and yet we would be redeemed from Egypt. Every subsequent cycle of Jewish history is all included in that promise that HaKadosh Baruch Hu made to Avraham Avinu, right? That, again, I just want to stress, this sounds like probably like a deeper explanation than what we've thought about when we've said or sung those words, but it's not like a nice vort, you know, pass the cholent sort of thing. That is just simply what the words mean, just when you think about what the Haggadah is actually saying. That's an incredibly powerful message, if you think about it. You know, all of Jewish history was already kind of spelled out to Avraham Avinu. And God gave Avraham Avinu a promise that would stand throughout all of time, that, you know, whatever happens to the Jewish people, God is always going to protect us, save us, and, you know, is going to bring us on, you know, to the next level. You know, that's a very, very powerful idea. The next section of the Haggadah, right after the Hisha'onda, we put down the coast, we cover over the matzos, and then comes about three pages in the Haggadah where, unfortunately, most people start spacing out. And as far as I know, there is no Haggadah that says, please space out at this point. You know, maybe someone will come out with one yet, I don't know. But inevitably, again, people here at Tzaddikim, they probably don't understand what I'm talking about. But again, you know, for those of us who are mere flesh and blood, this tends to be one of the lower points of the Haggadah in terms of attention span, because it's basically quotations of psukim and explanations. You know, the word you need, the phrase you need to know is kemo shenemar, as it says, kemo shenemar, kemo shenemar, kemo shenemar, kemo shenemar. What on earth is going on during those three pages? Right? So it's unfortunate that these three pages are given short shrift in so many people's homes, because actually these three pages are the crux of the Haggadah. What's going on during these three pages? So, the Torah tells us in the beginning of Parashas Kisavo that when the Jews lived in Eretz Yisrael, during the time that there was a Beis HaMikdash, when a farmer would bring his first fruits, his bikurim, to the Beis HaMikdash, you know, every season, like, you know, around now, So a little later, you know, from after Shavuos, so the farmer would bring his bikurim, his first fruits, and then he would make a declaration. The declaration, which is four psukim long, is basically a summary of the story of how we went down to Egypt, how we were redeemed from Egypt, and how God brought us to Eretz Yisrael. Right? The farmer in four verses sums up the whole story of how we went down to Egypt and how we were redeemed. The rabbis in the Mishnah say that four verse paragraph, which begins with the words Arami Oved Avi, Lavan, an Aramean, sought to destroy my forefather, that four pasuk paragraph should be the central theme of the Haggadah. The way in which we convey the story on the night of Pesach is not to tell the story straight out, but rather to take that four pasuk paragraph, to recite it, but as we're reciting it, to dissect each of the phrases and explain them in greater depth. So in other words, and that's exactly what we do for those three pages, right? Arami Ovid Avi, an Aramean sought to destroy my father. Kimal Shenema, as it says, and we quote some other proof to that idea. Or, you know, Vayotzino Hashem in Mitzrayim, God took us out of Egypt, what that really means, and then we go on to quote something else. And basically, phrase by phrase, we take those four psukim and dissect them, explaining and teasing out all of the meaning from those psukim so we can really, you know, understand in a deep way what those psukim are talking about. Now the question is, why do we do that? I mean, you know, again, for most of us sitting there, it's not necessarily the most enjoyable experience. Why don't we just, you know, wouldn't it be much more exciting if we just told over the stories the way they appear in the beginning of Chumash Shmos, when the story actually happens? I mean, if you get a kid's Haggadah, you know, they don't do any of this stuff. They have, like, cool pictures, and, you know, they tell the story, and Midrashim. And here we are, we're taking these four psukim and dissecting them in a very kind of academic way. Why are we doing that? So Rav Soloveitchik Zatzal explained that, you know, the Haggadah is not supposed to be just an act of telling. The Haggadah is primarily supposed to be an act of learning. We don't tell the story of how we left Egypt. We learn the story of how we left Egypt. And from a Jewish perspective, from a Torah perspective, the way you learn something, the way we learn anything, is to take a phrase and to try to understand what it means, to dissect it. Right? That's Jewish learning. We don't just tell stories. Right? As we take, you know, we take a text and we take, you know, layer after layer of the text. We try to peel away all of the layers of the onion and to understand what the text is really telling us. The fact that the Haggadah is set up in this fashion, which to us is not intuitive. We would have just told the story. But Senator Soloveitchik, the whole point is that, again, we're not just telling the story, we're learning the story. See, even if that's a little bit tedious, you know, as it says, but it's that very act of learning which, you know, makes us different as a people. We don't just tell stories. Stories are good, right? Not to set aside stories, but ultimately the way we're supposed to, you know, approach anything is to learn the Torah that's involved in it. So that's for three pages. We take apart, we dissect this story, the way it's presented in the Torah itself, because we want to not just tell over the story, we want to learn the story. When we're done with all of that, we sing Dayenu. Now, it's interesting, most of the songs we have at the end of the Haggadah. How did Dayenu rank, you know, to be stuck right in the middle of the Haggadah, right, before everybody's falling off their feet? Echad miyodea, I don't know, Echad miyodea. 1 o'clock was a really long time ago already, you know. Shnayim miyodea, yeah. I kind of remember 2 o'clock. Shlosha miyodea, I think 3 o'clock is coming up, right? You know, so why is the Dayenu right there in the middle? And I think the answer is because Dayenu, as we're going to see, is the end of the fourth section of the Haggadah. So far we've done three sections of the Haggadah. Vigadata, Levincha, Bayomahu. The fourth section of the Haggadah says, of the Magid, says the Malbim, is lemor, saying. Right? Saying means we tell over the actual story. And that's the biggest part of the Maggid. And because it's such a big chunk, again, going through, you know, all of these psukim and explaining them and learning them and all of that, we mark the end of that section with a little song to kind of be a page marker, you know, so to speak, a demarcation line between what we finished and what's going to come. Right after Dayenu, we introduce the paragraph that says Rabban Gamliel used to say, if you haven't spoken about the Karban Pesach, Matzah and Maror on Pesach, you haven't fulfilled your obligation. And we go on to explain why in biblical times, or in Beis HaMikdash times, we ate the Karban Pesach, the sacrifice, why nowadays we eat the Matzah, why nowadays we eat the Maror, and we explain, you know, what each of those things is all about. We mentioned before that on the surface, this is a rather curious place to place Rabban Gamliel's statement. If Rabban Gamliel says that these three things and talking about them is essential to fulfilling your mitzvah on the night of Pesach, so why stick it all the way at the end of the Maggid? By this time already, you know, a lot of people have been spacing out. Why not put it like at the beginning? I mean, if it was me, again, they didn't ask me, but if it would have been me, I would have said, right after the kid asks the Manishtana, so do the Rabban Gamliel thing. I mean, the truth is, the Rabban Gamliel paragraph directly answers two out of the four questions. Right? Why do we eat matzah? Okay, this is why we eat matzah. Why do we eat maror? Okay, this is why we eat maror. Why do we recline? That I'm not going to tell you. When you get older, you know, why do we dip twice? Look, everything you want, right? Two out of four is not bad, right? If a parent answers two out of four of his kids' questions, I mean, that's already that's ahead of the game. No, but two out of the four of the questions are answered right there, right? So why not put Rabban Gamliel like right after the Manishtana? So says the Malbim, again, go back to the Pasuk. V'igadot levincha b'yom ahu leimor, you should tell your son on that day saying, ba'avur zeh, because of this. Says the Malbim, whenever the term zeh is employed by the Pasuk, this, the rabbis always interpret it that you're pointing to something tangible. And says the Malbim, the mitzvah on the night of the Seder is not simply to tell the story of how we left Egypt. That's part of the mitzvah. But the mitzvah is also to use props to show how we to tell the story of how we left Egypt. Years ago, when I was in college, I took speech. Since then, they eliminated the speech department at Yeshiva University. But back in my day, that was a required course. We all had to take speech. I think you had to give like three speeches over the course of the semester. We had a debate at the end of the. Okay. No. That. Oh, I don't know. That part I don't remember. But we had one of the speeches we had to give was you were supposed to give a speech with a visual aid. In other words, you had to give a speech with a thing, and you had to reference the thing, you know, during the course of the speech. For the life of me, I can't remember what I actually did, but there was some thing, you know, that was involved in it. So the Malbim is basically saying on the night of Pesach, not only do we have to give a speech, but then about how we left Egypt, we then have to give a speech with a visual aid. Right? What are the visual aids? In the time when there was the Beis HaMikdash, the Karban Pesach, again, it's hard for us to fathom, but imagine sitting down to a Seder table with a huge roast lamb in the middle of the table. That was what a Seder looked like in the good old days. Right? It is even before the good old Starim on Hester Street. This is like in the really good old days, right? A big, solid lamb sitting in the middle of the table. That was the Karban Pesach. Everybody ate that. So the Karban Pesach was sitting in the middle of the table. So everybody would point to the Karban Pesach and say, this is why we eat this. Then they'd hold up the matzah, which we still do. This is why we eat the matzah. And you point to the maror. This is why we eat the maror, right? It was a speech with visual aids. That's ba'avur zeh. For the sake of this. That's why we can't bring in Rabban Gamliel until we're at this point in the Seder. Because again, follow the Malbim. You have to follow the pasuk. Vigarato levincha bayomahu leimor ba'avur zeh. Only once you finish leimor, right, the telling of the story as a story, only then can we do ba'avur zeh, the telling of the story with visual aids. It's everything is with a seder. It's planned out. So we've done 5 out of 6 parts. The 6th part of the Maggid is the end of the pasuk. Asa Hashem li b'tzeisim Mitzrayim. Because of this, God did for me when I left Egypt. The last part of the Maggid is for us to identify with the people who left Egypt. Right, not just to tell over the story as something that happened long ago, but to feel asa li, Hashem did it for me, to feel like we were actually there and we were redeemed, and we're not just talking about ancient history, we somehow put ourselves in the shoes of those who actually experienced Yetzias Mitzrayim. What happens in the Haggadah right after the Pesach Matzah Maror? B'chol dor v'dor chayov adam liros es asmo ki'ilu hu yotza mimitzrayim. In every generation, a person has to see himself as if he personally left Egypt. Shenemar, as it says, and here's the kicker, v'garato levincha bayoma huleymar ba'avor zeh osa Hashem li b'vitzeisim mimitzrayim. At the very end of the Maggid, we quote the pasuk that has served as the motif for the entire Maggid as we've gone through step by step. Right after we say that paragraph, we then say, Lefichach anachnu chayovim lahodos. Because we feel that we left Egypt, it's not just them, it's us, we now have to sing songs of praises to you. And we go on to recite the first 2 paragraphs of Hallel. Now, you ever wonder about that? We break up Hallel on the night of the Seder, right? In other words, the first 2 paragraphs are at the end of Maggid, and then all of the rest of Hallel is at the end of the Seder in a separate category called Hallel. I don't get it. Why are we breaking up Hallel? Like, if you're going to have a Hallel section at the end of the Haggadah, so put all of the Hallel at the end of the Haggadah. Why are you doing the first 2 paragraphs at the end of the Maggid? The answer is because Maggid is not just about recounting the story. Maggid is about experiencing the story. And if you're experiencing the story, if you really feel like you're leaving Egypt, you need to thank God. You need to sing praises of God because you're going through the experience right now. So why not all of Hallel? So the Abar Benel in his commentary on the Haggadah says, if you look at the themes of Hallel, the first 2 paragraphs of Hallel recount the events of Yetzias Mitzrayim. Everything from Lolanu to the end, you know, the rest of Hallel, is all talking about events that will take place when Mashiach comes. And that's something else to throw in there. Again, we won't get into too much. But essentially, the part of the Haggadah, which is after the meal, the last cup and Hallel and all of that, is all about the future. Because as much as, you know, we celebrate the fact that we left Egypt on the night of the Seder, we then transition into the idea that just like you redeemed us in the past, we look forward to you redeeming us in the future. But that's post-meal. Pre-meal, we're focused on the past, then we eat, and then after the eating, so then we look into the future and we talk about how God is going to redeem us. Not just that He did redeem us in the past, but how He's going to redeem us. We finish up with the Hallel, these 2 paragraphs of Hallel, and in doing so, we're fulfilling in the greatest way, you know, what the mandate of the Maggid is, not just to recount the story, but to feel as if we personally are experiencing the story. Right? Let's just bring it full circle here for a moment. So the Malbim has laid out, every time I say it over, I'm just blown away by this Malbim, because the Malbim on a certain level is just so simple. Right? Yeah. The whole Haggadah is really just following the 6 parts of the Pasuk. But it's so simple and yet so profound at the same time. It totally changes the way you look at the Haggadah. But let's bring it full circle now. So the Maggid started off asking, who has to tell the story of Yetzias Mitzrayim? So the answer to that was, everybody. You've gone through Shas 4,000 times, and you know the story of Yetzias Mitzrayim backwards and forwards. Doesn't matter. Still have to tell over the story. So why is that? I mean, if you really know the story really well, let's say you're like a Yetzias Mitzrayim expert, right? You know, you built your house like a pyramid, like whatever. You're very into Yetzias Mitzrayim. You know it like backwards and forwards. So why do you have to tell it over every year? So the answer to that question is really at the end of the Maggid. If this was just an academic exercise that we just need to review what happened, you're right. I mean, at a certain point, a person knows what. Okay, we left 10 makos. 10 makos. Oh, yeah. I'll tell you what. You get the basic story. You get. But it's not an academic exercise. The mitzvah on the night of the Seder is an experiential one. A person is supposed to feel like they personally left Mitzrayim.
That's what it says.
Right. So no matter how wise you are, right, you still need to do that. In other words,
you have to learn it.
Right. Well, you have to learn it and get into it and internalize it. In other words, if it was just an academic exercise, you need to know about it. Okay, at a certain point, you know about it. You've done it 5,000 times already. You know exactly what happened. But it's not an academic exercise. It's an experiential exercise. You have to feel something. You have to feel like you left Mitzrayim. So that, no matter how smart you are, you have to come back to that every year, because no amount of academic preparation alone can prepare you for a feeling. A feeling is something that you have to work on year in and year out to really be able to experience. That's the mandate of the Seder, and that's really what we're trying to do on a yearly basis. So hopefully this approach, is, again, like we said before, simple but profound at the same time, and really, gives us a little bit of insight into what the Haggadah is all about.
Being that we're women here.
Yeah.
Question, and I'm not trying to be on the negative side,
yeah.
But it says the
Haggadah, right?
Meaning it's addressing a man, rather than, does it mean that everybody, including women, are obligated to recount the story? And if so, why would they give it just in a masculine singular? And Levincha, only to your son, why phrase it in terms of a son rather than son and daughter? And what if somebody isn't married yet? Somebody's married without children. Why does the Haggadah
in masculine
seem to emphasize specific?
Right. No, excellent. So that was argumentative? Nah, that's nothing. Right. So first of all, it's important to realize. Let me answer the question on two levels. I mean, first of all, it's just important to realize in the Hebrew language, masculine can be used for masculine alone. It can also be used for men and women. So in other words, let's go back to those verb tables that we learned once upon a time. So aten omedos, right? You female are standing. But if I have a group of men and women, I say atem omdim, right? Even though it's male. All right, so you can ask me why that is.
Refers only to
right, so you can ask me why that is, but so I don't know, but that is true in Hebrew. In other words, the masculine voice can be used for both men and women together. However, that doesn't really answer the question, because the question still is, what is the nature of the obligation of women in the mitzvah of Sipur Yetzias Mitzrayim, right? In other words, when it says, when it uses
it's
the
it's a specific time that the Seder is
right. So the consensus of halachic authorities is that women are certainly obligated in the mitzvah of Sipur Yetzias Mitzrayim. In other words, that the mitzvah of telling over the story certainly applies to women. There is a debate whether the obligation is incumbent upon women mida araisa, according to Torah law. In other words, is the pasuk talking about women, right? Is the pasuk talking about women in addition to men? In which case, vigadata means you, men and women, livincha to your sons and daughters, right? In other words, because everybody is obligated. Is that the case, or maybe women are obligated midirabbanon? Maybe they're obligated rabbinically. How would they be obligated rabbinically? So we spoke about this briefly on Shabbos, actually, Shalashudas. Women are certainly obligated to drink the four cups of wine on the night of the Seder. the four cups of wine are each associated with mitzvos that we do on the night of the Seder. The second cup of wine specifically is associated with the mitzvah to recount the Exodus. That's why we fill up that kos at the beginning of the Maggid and drink it at the end of the Maggid. We're reciting the Maggid over the second cup, which is full. Which is, by the way, we pointed out over Shabbos. Sometimes people think, oh, let me just fill it up before I'm ready to drink it, right? In other words, why do I have to fill it up by the Manishtana and then drink it at the very end of Maggid? I mean, it's just sitting there, a good wine sitting there, you know, it loses some of the bouquet or whatever it loses, I don't know. You know, it's just sitting there, you know, for however long I'm saying the Maggid. No, that's very important. Because the same way you wouldn't make Kiddush over an empty cup of wine and then just fill it up when you're ready to drink it, that doesn't make any sense. So by the same token, the cup has to be filled, you know, for the duration of the Maggid, and I can drink it at the end. Rav Moshe Soloveitchik, we told this over on Shabbos, Rav Moshe Soloveitchik once had a guest at his Seder who towards the end of the Maggid spilled his cup of wine. So Rav Moshe Soloveitchik told him, refill your cup, go back to Avarim Hayinu and start reciting the Maggid over again. Right? Because in other words, now that you've spilled the cup, you lost out on being able to say the Maggid over that cup of wine. So go back and do it again. He was very careful never to spill anything after that, presumably. But in other words, that's the idea behind it. So women are obligated in the four cups. So maybe once they're obligated in the four cups, they become obligated in the mitzvah of telling over the story of Yetzias Mitzrayim as a part of that mitzvah to drink the four cups. But one way or the other, women are certainly chayv. And we pointed out over Shabbos that, again, for various reasons, good reasons, women often find themselves up and down. You know, they're not always sitting at the table constantly throughout the Seder. That's what they tell me. So it's important, again, you know, let's say a woman has to go take care of the children, the cooking, whatever it happens to be. When women have to absent themselves from the table, they should come back and make up what they missed, right? So, and even if that means you're a little bit out of sync with everybody else, you may end up drinking the kosos at different times because you're kind of out of sync a little bit. That's okay. There's no mitzvah that you have to be in sync with everybody else.
So when you say you have to, you know, hit up matamara that you're supposed to be there.
Well, you have to say it, meaning if you're not in sync with everyone, well, in other words, if the baby starts crying right when Rabban Gamliel is about to speak, you put Rabban Gamliel on hold for a few minutes, you go take care of the baby, but then when you come back to the table, you do have to say, right, go back to Rabban Gamliel, don't leave him hanging. You know, so you have to go back and, you know, you have to say over Pesach, Matzah, Maror, you have to make sure you say everything. Right? Just, but you know, you're not necessarily going to be in sync with everybody. That's okay. I mean, sometimes a crying baby means that the woman can come back to the table and she's still doing matzah while everyone is doing karech. I mean, it could be. I mean, again, if the other people at the table are nice, they'll wait for her. But sometimes that's not always possible. You know, sometimes the baby really needs a lot of attention. Sometimes the you know, if I can say such a thing for those of us who eat them, sometimes the knelach need a lot of attention. You'll excuse me. I mean, I hope there are no galatianers there. You know, it's, there's certain things that you know sometimes need attention and they just have to be taken care of. And that's okay, that's legitimate, that's, you know, that's what it's all about. You're building a, you know, a Jewish home. And but you know, there has to be a certain amount of catch up, you know, when you come back to the table. Okay, we want to, yeah, I'm sorry. So the Gemara says if a person is making a Seder by themselves, very lonely, but it happens, so you actually ask yourself the questions. Meaning, the idea of Igada to Levincha is that the Haggadah is supposed to be a dialogue, right? And it's presented as a dialogue. Now, dialogues usually require more than one person, but sometimes you can dialogue with yourself if you don't have another example. So in other words, what would happen if you sat down to a table by yourself? Your mom is making a Seder for yourself, very lonely, but it happens. So the Gemara says, you ask yourself the Manishtana, and then you answer. Right? Vigadat Levincha is the Torah's way of saying that the story is not supposed to be a monologue, it's supposed to be a dialogue. And even if it's, if it ends up being a dialogue, you know, you're talking to yourself, but it's presented in the format of a dialogue. Right? That's what he got it to live in for. Okay. So I think we...